Well, in the days leading up to Sunday's 50th anniversary of Roe, the Supreme Court released its final report into who leaked the draft of last summer's Dobbs decision that overturned Roe v. Wade. And we learned not much. After interviewing nearly 100 court employees, looking at computers, printer records, call and text logs, investigators could really not say who had leaked the decision or how it had ended up in the hands of the Politico reporters who published it. We're going to talk about what we know and what we don't and what the findings of this breach mean for the future of the court with Jessica Levinson, professor at Loyola Law School and our regular legal here on Press Play. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
All right. So these reports are usually full of legalese, legal jargon. This one is no exception. But there's one line I want you to talk about in this report. It says, investigators have been unable to determine at this time, using a preponderance of the evidence standard, the identity of the persons who disclosed the draft majority opinion. What do you make of that?
I think it means that they don't know, or they stopped when they thought, oh my gosh, maybe we might find out. But I think option number one is the most likely. Preponderance of the evidence is basically the lowest standard in the law. It just means more likely than not. And so they're making it clear that it's not that they really think they have somebody, they just can't show proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the standard in a criminal case. What they're saying here is, we really don't know. Based on, as you said, they interviewed 97 people, some people more than once. Many people signed affidavits. They had to swear under oath to the truth of their answers. They are saying, we really don't know.
And did they actually interview the justices? And I know there was some fair amount of pushback after this report came out on Thursday that the justices were not subject to affidavits.
That's right. So they did interview the justices, but I think the word interview here is probably doing a lot of work in the sense that the law clerks and the court staff, I think, had very different interviews. As we mentioned, some of the law clerks, I think, had to sign affidavits under oath under penalty of perjury, saying that all of the information that they gave to the investigators was true. I believe that's why a number of the clerks admitted that they speak to their spouses about some of these decisions, that they do, in fact, talk to their significant others about things that they shouldn't. And I think that the interview with the justices, frankly, had a much lighter touch. And the reporting indicates that they were not asked to sign anything.
So this was supposed to restore some confidence in the court after this huge security breach. Did it do that?
I don't think it did, in part based on what we were just talking about. You know, on the Supreme Court, on the building itself, it says equal justice under law. And when you treat the justices different from everybody else, that doesn't feel particularly equal. And there are a number of things where there are a number of steps along the way where I think we can look at how this investigation was conducted, who Chief Justice Roberts even decided to be in charge of the investigation, a marshal, not, for instance, the Department of Justice, and say, we're not sure that this was really ever designed ultimately to find the leaker. Now, look, I don't want to say this was a sham investigation. I do not think it was under any circumstances. The former head of the Department of Homeland Security looked and said this was a thorough investigation, but not one, I think, that really restored our confidence in the institution.
So that's it? There'll be no more investigations? We'll just never really know?
I think we'll know when the book comes out in 10 or 20 or 30 years, when somebody says, I think it's going to be like a deep throat moment for Watergate, where we didn't know for years. And then there's a book, there's a famous book about the Supreme Court called The Brethren, where a number of the law clerks spoke to the authors. And then we really got a behind the scenes look. I think we'll find out at some point, but the investigation at this point is done. And I think the court is really hoping it's done because they want to move on to, you know, changing the direction of the law in our country.
Okay, let's change direction in terms of our conversation and come closer to home and talk about former LA City Councilman Jose Huizar. He pleaded guilty to charges of tax evasion and racketeering. He admitted he took at least $1.5 million in bribes from real estate developers, and the sentencing hasn't been scheduled yet. But in his plea deal, prosecutors said they would not request a sentence longer than 13 years. But Huizar can't ask for a sentence less than 9 years. So is that fairly normal? Seems like a long sentence for a white collar crime.
It does seem like a long sentence, but I think all of the evidence indicates, and Huizar has at this point admitted, that he really did run a criminal enterprise and to the detriment of the public. He was in a position of public trust. He abused that. And this wasn't a one-off. What we know from other people who pled guilty, people who worked for him, and the people who apparently bribed him, is that this was a fairly lengthy criminal scheme. And the federal government does typically take abuse of the public trust seriously. So yes, this is real prison time, and I think it deserves real prison time.
So he was basically accused of taking all sorts of money and other bribes, such as casino gambling chips, flights on private jets, luxury hotel stays. He and others, concert tickets. Another councilman has already served time. How big was this scandal, this pay-to-play scandal in Los Angeles?
I think it's quite big, and it shows that, frankly, we have a number of cracks in the system. I don't think that that will be news to people who listen to your program and are very educated about Los Angeles politics. Part of Huizar's story is a story of how we approve land use deals in our city and how much power individual city council members have, depending on which district they sit in and depending on which committees they sit in, over these incredibly big proposed developments. And again, we're talking about tens of millions of dollars, sometimes even more. And developers really want these projects to go through. And there are people like Jose Huizar who abuse the system. Now, there's no perfect system, but I think what we've seen in a number of instances, and this being maybe the most infamous, is that we do have those who ask for our trust and then abuse our trust.
Jessica Levinson is a professor at Loyola Law School and Press Play's Legal Eagle. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a record number of films at this year's Sundance Film Festival.
65% of the films chosen this year are from women filmmakers. There are a record number of works from indigenous filmmakers, films by Asian filmmakers, black filmmakers.
We'll have a report from Park City next on Press Play.